Did you read a great book this year? You know, the kind of science book where you want to shake that person next to you on the bus and say, hey, did you know? Wow, I just read in the book here. You learned something so cool. You just have to share it. Well, I had a few ideas, a few books that I read. Let me give you some of my picks. There was Walter Isaacson's The Innovators, about the birth of computers and the Internet. I had Matt Miodovnik's Stuff Matters. I like that book, about the science of everyday materials. Rachel Sussman's The Oldest Living Things in the World. I didn't know there were things that lived this. They had photos of 100,000-year-old seagrass, 5,000-year-old moss. Wasn't even growing in my bathroom. The list goes on, and for the rest of the hour, it's our choice for the best science books of 2014, and we want your topics. If you got topics out there, please share them with us. We've got a panel of experts here to advise us. And our number, 844-724-8255, 844-724-8255. Deborah Blum is a professor of journalism, University of Wisconsin in Madison. She's also the editor of this year's Best American Science and Nature Writing 2014 and the author of The Poisoner's Handbook. Welcome back, Deborah.
Thanks. It's great to be back.
Are we going to have poisoner stuff again this year or no poison books?
This has been a really disappointing year for chemical killings of other human beings.
Oh, I'm sorry. I'm sure CSI is sorry to hear that, too.
Yes.
Also, Annalee Newitz is a founding editor of the sci-fi blog io9.com, and her most recent book is Scatter, Adapt, and Remember How Humans Will Survive a Mass Extinction. Love that book. Welcome to Science Friday.
Thanks for having me.
Well, let me, since you're right here, Annalee, tell us what your top pick would be for this year.
Well, I don't know if it would be my top pick, but one of my top picks is Jordan Ellenberg's How Not to Be Wrong. And not only is that a great title, because, of course, no one wants to be wrong, but Ellenberg is a mathematician who really knows how to make math into something that we want to learn more about. And he's very sneaky. He'll tell you stories that make you realize that you've been kind of doing math in your everyday life already all the time, and you just didn't realize it. Mm-hmm. And so his book covers everything from the math behind getting to airports on time to the math behind why businesses tend to become mediocre over time. And it's just a really fun ride. And if you thought you hated math, you'll find out that actually you've secretly loved it your whole life.
Wow, that's good to know. Deborah, if there are not any crime books and poisoning books, bad chemical books out, any big trends in science books that you've picked up this year?
Well, you know, it's interesting because usually I look for sort of a fantastic narrative. If I went back a few years, Rebecca Skloot's The Immortal Life of Henrietta Lacks is an example. And this year I didn't see that as much as sort of books that focused on intriguing or fascinating ideas. So I didn't have that so much narrative on my list as much as, wow, that's really interesting.
Hmm. So what book would you...
I have one narrative.
Yeah.
So the one narrative on my list is, I hope I am going to say this guy's name right, The Fantastic Laboratory of Dr. Weigel by Arthur Allen. And it's just an amazing story.
Well, what makes it amazing? Give us a little brief idea.
I love science. It's a science history book. And I love science history that pulls something that we've forgotten or didn't fully appreciate it sort of out of the closet of history, right?
Yeah.
And sits it out in front of you where you weren't paying attention. And so Rudolf Weigel was a Polish researcher who was one of the early developers of the vaccine for typhus. And he did this in this very gruesome way, which involved bringing lice into his laboratory and having them chew on people's legs for a while, and then he'd mash them up and create the typhus vaccine, because lice carry typhus. And the Nazis drafted him to make typhus vaccine for their soldiers at the front. And he created this sort of underground secret resistance in his laboratory. The people he brought in to be the lice carriers were all people who were threatened with going to the concentration camps. He had sometimes 1,000 people from the Polish ghettos in there. And he brought in not only Polish people who were in trouble, but Jews were in trouble. And one of them actually did eventually end up in Buchenwald, where he was again drafted by the Nazis to make a typhus vaccine, and actually, and it's so slippery and sneaky, made two versions of the vaccine, one that worked, which he gave to the people in the concentration camp, and one that didn't, which he sent to the front.
Wow.
And so you see this fantastic, ethically complicated science story. I mean, it's just fascinating.
Mm-hmm. Great story. Our number is 844-724-8255, sharing your book titles on Science Friday from PRI, Public Radio International. Talking with our book reviewers, Anna Lee Newitz and Deborah Blum. Anna Lee, your book is sort of about surviving, how humans will survive a mass extinction. Any other books of that genre that you came across?
Actually, yeah, there was a great book that came out from Anthony Barnosky called Dodging Extinction, which is a really beautifully written piece. Barnosky has two hats. He's a paleontologist, which means he's sort of studying the ancient history of life on Earth, but he's also a zoologist who looks at sort of the variety of animals we have now. And he's one of the people who worked on a very important scientific paper published a few years ago with a number of other eminent scientists arguing that we are in the early stages of a sixth mass extinction. And, you know, so there have been five others on Earth, and he's sort of studied these, the most recent being when the dinosaurs died out. And he just makes the case in this book in this very approachable way, explaining how it is that the numbers of extinctions we're seeing among land animals really, this is really an early warning sign that we're looking at a possible apocalypse in terms of life on Earth. And the part about the book that I think is really great is that he doesn't just leave you with a sense of doom. He actually spends most of the book talking about the ways in which we could fix this problem, because the fact is that mass extinctions take hundreds of thousands of years, and we're probably fairly early on in one. And so he says, look, there's a number of ways we can fix this. We can look at our agricultural practices. We can look at the way we're taking care of animals. We can look at how we allocate money. And he, by the time that you finish this book and you've followed him to Africa and you followed him to, you know, fossil digs all over North America, you have this sense that we really do have a chance to make things right, but we'd better start doing it now. And it's a very learned book, but like I said, it's very approachable and fun. I mean, as fun as mass extinction can be. And I think it gives you a sense of what I would call kind of rational optimism. Mm-hmm. And so I think anyone who's sort of interested in the future of the planet or loves animals really should check this one out.
Mm-hmm. The name of the book again is
Dodging Extinction.
Power, Food, Money, and the Future of Life on Earth.
That's right.
Small topic.
Yeah, just a tiny topic, yeah.
Tiny topic. We're gonna take a little break. We're talking with Deborah Blum, professor of journalism at the University of Wisconsin in Madison. She's also editor of this year's Best American Science and Nature Writing 2014, author of The Poisoner's Handbook, Anna Lee Newitz, founding editor of the sci-fi blog io9. com, and her most recent book is Scatter, Adapt, and Remember, How Humans Will Survive a Mass Extinction. We invite you to tell us we invite you to suggest a book for us, 844-724-8255. Maybe the book you're going to suggest is A Mass Extinction, although I did hear one book editor the other day say, if I get another post-apocalyptic sci-fi novel, I'm just going to scream. So I've read a lot of them. So we'll be right back after this break. Stay with us. This is Science Friday. I'm Ira Flatto. We're talking this hour about the best science books this year. And if you've got a nomination, give us a call at 844-724-8255. With me is Deborah Blum, editor of this year's Best American Science and Nature Writing. And also with me is Anna Lee Newitz, founding editor of io9.com, author of Scatter, Adapt, and Remember. Our number, 844-724-8255. We have lots of folks who want to talk about it. Let's go to Terry in San Antonio. Hi, welcome to Science Friday.
Hi, Ira. Thank you so much. Mm-hmm. I actually have a recommendation, the book What If by Randall Monroe. I'm sure he's a favorite around there. The subtitle, Serious Scientific Answers to Absurd Hypothetical Questions.
Well, Annalie, you were nodding your head on that one. You like that one? You like that?
Yeah, I mean, who doesn't really? I mean, Randall Monroe like won all of our hearts when the Orion craft was. Oh, sorry, not the Orion craft. When we were landing on the comet, and he was doing a live update of what was happening to the craft as it was landing, and turned it into a GIF. So, I mean, that's just a tiny example of the great things he does for science communication.
Deborah?
Yeah, actually, that was one of the books on my list, too. I love that book, and I love the way it's set up where he poses what might seem like a ridiculous question. My favorite was, if everyone on the planet stayed away from each other for a couple of weeks, wouldn't the common cold be wiped out? And then he looks at, well, how would we isolate the entire planet? And then, would it work? And you just find yourself more and more caught up in these thought experiments. It's really kind of brilliant.
Terry, what did you like so much about the book?
What is not to like about the book? To give a great example, I work a very manual labor job, and I spend quite a bit of time in a truck with a couple of other people. And one of these young men, this 19-year-old, he really doesn't read. And I was reading excerpts from the book. He's completely unscientific, not into literature at all, but I would randomly read things out as we were driving, and I caught him reading over my shoulder. At one point, I gave him the book, and he read for 2 hours straight. And when he was done, the first thing he said was, I'm going to go buy this book, because it can really hold your attention in that they're very short blocks. It's not a long narrative. And it goes from one subject to another, and it's just incredibly funny and creative while giving you a lot of background in whatever it is he's discussing in that 3, 4, 8-page chapter.
What a great story, Terry. Thanks. That's a great story. Thanks for sharing that with us, and have a good holiday. Yeah, what is there not to like? What a great review of that. Deborah, have you got another pick for us?
Yeah, it's interesting. I really, really liked The Glass Cage by Nicholas Carr. I was saying that the books that really spoke to me this year were ones where I thought, that's an interesting idea. And so The Glass Cage is subtitled Automation and Us. And it almost poses this idea as we automate our lives more, as we allow machines to navigate our everyday life rather than using our own brains, do the machines become smarter and we become dumber? And so he takes an example like GPS, which worked for me. My older son lives in Chicago. I GPS my way down to where he lives. I've been doing this now for 3 years. I still have no idea where he lives, right? And right. People will go, I'll go, oh, he lives in Uptown. People go, where is that? I go, it's somewhere in Chicago. But my GPS knows. So he looks at that in all kinds of ways in which we're sort of turning over our cognitive processes to machines. He looks at the consequences in the way we train airline pilots and the way that that's actually played into plane crashes. And he just makes you think about something I don't think we do enough, which is, this is the next best thing. But do we want to approach it thoughtfully, or do we want to approach it without thinking about it at all?
Mm. Because Ray Kurzweil, Stephen Hawking, they've written now about machines getting too smart for us, danger in that.
In a real sci-fi sense, but this is more, here's something I do every day. I don't think about where I'm going. I don't create mental maps. I don't think about how the instruments work on, and he gives this some horrifying examples of this, how the instruments really need to work in the panel of my airplane because machines are doing it for me. Mm-hmm. And so he makes you see the trade-off of it. Hmm. Less robots taking over the world and more, don't you want to be smart?
Yeah. Let's go to Michelle in Tucson. Hi, welcome to Science Friday.
Hi, how you doing?
Hey there.
I read a book this year, Dr. Mutter's Marvels, about a surgeon who pioneered plastic surgery in the 1800s, before anesthesia. He pioneered a procedure for a cleft palate that is still used today. And the narrative is fascinating. This guy was amazing. working with people. He was one of the first physicians to actually put his hands on a patient and talk to them during a surgery rather than treat them as an object. He was the first guy to send a patient to a recovery room instead of stick them in a carriage and send them home.
Right.
Just amazing stuff this man did that brought us to places that we would not be now if he hadn't been around. Great book.
Yeah, I'm trying to think if I'm mixing names up here, but isn't there in the museum in Philadelphia that's named after?
Guy. That's all his stuff. Yeah.
Yeah. Deborah, what do you think about that?
I love that museum. It's one of the best and creepiest museums in the world. And actually, your caller makes me want to read that book. I haven't read that much about the story of Dr. Mutter, but his museum is just like the most amazing reminder of how we've fumbled and felt and thought our way through all kinds of bizarre ideas in medicine. It's like a mind trip to go to that museum.
844-724-8255. Another pick?
Yeah, I'm going to be controversial and pick a social science pick. And this is a book called The Coming Swarm by communications researcher Molly Sauter. And the thing that's... This is basically a book about protest movements online on the internet. And she does an incredible job explaining how movements like Anonymous, how groups like WikiLeaks work technically, giving you a very good background in how things like a distributed denial of service attack works. How does that take down a website? Why do people do that? How do political groups organize to do that? And give us this sense of a sort of futuristic world of political protest. But the great part about this book is that she places it in the context of a long history of civil disobedience in the West. And so she reminds you at every step of the way that these things that seem like a brand new movement online or that seem like they've never happened before are actually continuations of the way that people have always protested and have always subverted, but they're now using new kinds of tools and they're going after different kinds of targets. And so you'll come away from this book understanding what's happening online right now much better, but also kind of seeing how there's a continuity.
Yeah. So in one case, it's just a handbook to tell you how to understand these things.
Yeah.
And it's a warning at the same time.
Well, I don't know if it's a warning. It's a handbook in the sense that she explains the technology. Like, if you want to know what a DDoS attack is, you will leave this book understanding. But at the same time, I feel like there's a lot of hopefulness, too, because what she's saying is, you know, the internet is not a place where we become sort of passive consumers of politics. It's also a place of activism if it's done right and if it's if it helps people understand how a group is being marginalized or how a group is being oppressed. And of course, all these tools can be used for nefarious purposes as well, just like protests can be nefarious. Right. But she's also showing that this is, as I said, I mean, it really goes back to, you know, Thoreau's idea of civil disobedience, which I think most of us consider to be a virtue, at least in the United States. And so she's really tying it into values that we can understand.
Let's go to the phones to Ben in Anchorage. Hi, Ben.
Good morning, or at least good morning for me. I guess it's good afternoon for you. I would like to nominate a fantastic book, which I believe is not only the best science book that I have read, but probably the most important book I feel like I have ever read, and that is written by Naomi Klein, a Canadian journalist. And the title is This Changes Everything. And it is a discussion of not only the science from a material science point of view, but also the geopolitics of climate change. And it's really a remarkable book. She goes into detail about the physics and atmospheric dynamics behind climate change. And then she peels back the layers and she shows that really, you know, the really inconvenient truth is that not only is climate change absolutely occurring, but that it's not about, or not solely about carbon. And it's about politics. It's about capitalism, and she brings, she ties together the World Trade Organization and trade policies and the effect that these geopolitical structures and tools have affected climate change. So it's just fantastic book. I think it should be required reading for everybody.
All right. That's boy, if Ben said it was the most important book he's ever read. He seems like he's a well-read person.
One of my students, Allie Tempest, was a researcher on that book, so of course I love the book. But what I really like about it, and I think Ben makes that point really well, is that it reminds us that science doesn't exist in a vacuum, right? Mm-hmm. It operates in this whole world system of who we are and our politics and our economics, and so, you know, we can't just set it aside over here on some glass-walled laboratory and say, oh, that's science. It's completely mixed up with what we're doing today.
Yeah. Our number 844-724-8255, talking with Deborah Blum and Annalee Newitz on Science Friday from PRI, Public Radio International. Okay, Annalee, a sci-fi pick, a science fiction pick for us.
So I'm going to recommend something that is a book that might not at first seem like it deals with science. And this is a book called Maplecroft by Sherry Priest. And Sherry Priest is well known as a historical writer. She writes alternative history. And here she's taken on the history of Lizzie Borden, the famous axe murderess who killed her family at the turn of the last century. But in her retelling, it wasn't really a murder because Lizzie Borden was fighting Lovecraftian monsters of the deep. And so she had to kill them with an axe because they were turning into monsters. And the story is about what happens to Lizzie and her sister after her parents' death and after she's acquitted of the murder. And historically, in real life, Lizzie and her sister did go live in a mansion called Maplecroft. And Lizzie had a lover who is an actress who came and scandalized the town a couple of times. And in this novel, her sister is a scientist, and she's quite an accomplished scientist. She's a biologist, and she's collecting samples that turn out to be connected to these monsters that are turning people into things that we need to kill with axes. And it becomes this incredibly well-observed story, not just about sibling rivalry, but also about the difference between the scientific worldview and a kind of supernatural worldview. And Lizzie really believes that the only way to fight these creatures is through magic, basically, and through being kind of a magical warrior. And her sister views them as part of the natural world and is carrying on this correspondence with a number of other scientists who are studying them, who, of course, all think that she's a man, because why would a woman ever make great discoveries? And so we get into this sort of rich world that has these supernatural trappings, but also really grapples with these incredible issues. And it's really a page turner, too. So if you have kind of a long wintry night where you want to think about, you know, scary monsters, but also social issues of the time, I highly recommend Maplecroft.
A page turner.
It is. Yeah. Well, I mean, they're fighting monsters.
You're right.
I mean, come on.
Deborah, any last recommendation from you?
Yeah, I want to mention On Immunity by Eula Bliss. And in my big, this is a year of idea books, this is an idea that is not new. It concerns vaccinations. It'll remind you in some ways in its basic sort of thrust of a really wonderful book of a couple of years ago, Seth Nookin's The Panic Virus. But Eula Bliss is a very talented essayist, and she looks at immunity. She looks at immunizations from just the point of view of history and interestingly enough, from motherhood and even from linguistics. So she makes the point, for instance, that when we talk about getting a vaccination, what we say is a shot, right? A really violent kind of term. And she makes you think about fear and logic and culture. And I think in this moment, when we all wonder about the spread of the anti-vaccination movement, it's just a really smart, wonderful book on an idea that it's fine to repeat because we need to keep repeating that conversation.
Mm-hmm. I add one of my science fiction picks of my own that I really enjoyed this year, and that was The Martian by Andy Weir, which is about a guy who is stranded on Mars by himself and how he has to cope with that. And I see, Annalie, you like that book also. It was a great book.
Yeah, no, I think it's sort of an instant classic.
Yeah, it's a great book. Well, thank you. Thank you for taking time to be with us today. Annalie Newitz, editor of io9.com, author of Scatter, Adapt, and Remember, How Humans Will Survive a Mass Extinction. A great book of itself, if you'd like to pick up.
Well, thank you very much.
Deborah Blum, professor of journalism at University of Wisconsin in Madison, editor of America's Best American Science and Nature Writing, author of The Poisoner's Handbook, among others. She's got so many books. Thank you. Thank you, Deborah, for taking time to be with us today.
Thanks so much.
And if you missed it, you can find all of our picks at our website. That's sciencefriday.com/sciencebooks2014. And for the younger readers on your list, we aren't leaving them out. You can find our top five science books for kids at our website. That's sciencefriday.com/kidsbooks.